So last week, I gave a revolutionary, earth-shattering, groundbreaking message. I don't think so, but on, you know, the role of women in the body of Christ. And I talked about how we should not be walking this walk without half of our body parts, basically. We're at the end of the summer. Summer's winding down. For some of us, that's a sad time because they love summer. They love the heat. They love the humidity. They love the grass getting dried out and burnt. And you touch your car, you might burn yourself. I love the fall. I love the spring. Those are my favorite seasons, fall and spring. I do like summer. I enjoy winter, but in moderation. And fall, growing up, I really looked forward to it. Not for school, right? Because you're going back to school. I didn't look forward to it for that. I looked forward to fall because of the fall holy days, right? I knew that trumpets was coming up, right? And I love trumpets. In Detroit, we got to get together with all of the Detroit churches. There were three different congregations in Detroit, and sometimes the Ann Arbor Church may join us or one of the other churches close by. So we'd have, you know, over 1,000 people, sometimes 1,500. We'd go to Roma Hall, later Burton Manor, and we'd get cannolis. And sometimes when people found out that I grew up in the church and I'm from Detroit, they still ask me about cannolis, and it's crazy. It was a good time, you know, growing up in the inner city and in what I call American poverty. I didn't really get to have those kinds of experiences. Now, atonement, I'm not gonna lie, it was not one of those days that I looked forward to, but I put it in my mind, atonement is something you have to go through to get to the Feast of Tabernacles. But that's how I understood it back then. You know, this is something that you have to do, right? In order to get to the good stuff, you have to do this in order to get to the good stuff. So I'll talk more about that on the Day of Atonement. But, you know, as you grow older and you walk this walk, have a better understanding of those holy days, these holy days that are coming up. And like the Sabbath and many things of the law, I embrace an understanding of these are things that we get to do, not have to do. And I think that mindset is important. The title of my message today is Walking Back into Grace. Walking Back into Grace. I'm going to open in Psalm 128. Psalm 128. In Psalm 128, verses 1 to 3, it reads like this. Blessed are all who fear the Lord, who walk in obedience to him. You will eat the fruit of your labor. Blessings and prosperity will be yours. Your wife will be like a vine, a fruitful vine within your house. Your children will be like olive shoots around your table. Now, I like that. I like that verse. I like that blessing that it gives, right? It talks about if you fear the Lord, if you walk in obedience with him, these are the things you will get because of your walk. It's no secret, I'm an immigrant. Sometimes they make jokes about how hard immigrants like to work. So in verse 2, when it says, you will eat the fruits of your labor, okay? I like that because it's telling me the more I labor, the more fruit I can get. I like fruit, especially mangoes. Blessings and prosperity will be yours. So wait, if I work hard and if I choose to walk with the Lord in obedience, blessing and prosperity will be mine. My wife will be like a fruitful vine within my house, and my children will be like olive shoots. I like this psalm. Everything this psalm says is true. But can I tell you something? It's not complete. It's not complete. Now, Psalm 128 is in a group of psalms, right? And I talk about that a lot during the Holy Day times. It's in the group of psalms called the Songs of Ascent. There are 15 of them, and it starts from Psalm 120, and it goes through to Psalm 134. And they call them the pilgrim psalms, the gradual psalms, the songs of the steps. Four are linked to King David, one to Solomon, and 10 are anonymous. The physical ascent and the walk to Jerusalem. See, Jerusalem is on a hill. And if you read the songs of ascent, one of them will start that way. This, traditionally, were the psalms that people sang and recited as they were on the pilgrimage to those holy days, those fall holy days that I talked about, as well as the spring ones. But they were moving from different places, and they were heading to Jerusalem. The themes of them are journey and pilgrims. And pilgrimage, trusting in God, and community, and joy. I like how Psalm 120, the first psalm, starts. It says, I call on the Lord in my distress, and he answers me. Save me, O Lord, from lying lips and deceitful tongues. When you think about the psalm, when you think about what they were going through, when I think about my life and looking to the fall holy days, for me, it was an escape. I was glad to get outside of the ghetto in inner city Detroit. I was glad that I'd go somewhere off nice, you know, like Wisconsin Dells, and I didn't have to hear gunshots every single night. Or dealing with gangbangers and drug dealers and drug abusers on my way to school and walking through dangerous neighborhoods. I was glad. Save me, O Lord, from lying lips and deceitful tongues and the Crips and the trap houses. The contrast between Psalm 128 in the beginning and Psalm 120 is what I want us to kind of focus on as I speak today. See, Psalm 128, when we look at it, it's true. I want to establish that it's true. So I'm not minimizing the truth that is in Psalm 128. But Psalm 128 is not the completeness of our walk. Psalm 128 focuses on obedience. Psalm 128 is talking about if you put in labor, you will reap good fruit. Psalm 128 says if you do these things, at least at the beginning, and again, it is true that your wife will be a fruitful vine and your children will be like olive shoots. Psalm 120 tells you that when you're in trouble, call in the Lord and he will save you. He's the one that's able to pull you out of this mess. So when I gave that contrast of the feast being something we have to do instead of something we get to do, it's that deeper understanding that I want to talk about today when I talk about grace. Right? I don't want us to come across this feast season as if we're special. God commanded us to keep these feasts, and we have this understanding that no one else has about these feasts. So because we have this understanding, we're going to get blessed, and we're going to get these extra special blessings and things like that. Now, you can walk in that. That is true, and you can get blessed, but it's not the complete story. Okay, I see some puzzled looks. I've always liked brisket. In some ways, I like brisket more than steak. I went to the feast a couple years ago in Texas, close to Austin, Texas. And one of my goals while I was down there in Texas was to eat as much barbecue as I can. Right? And we were around Lockhart, Texas, and there's the Lockhart franchise, and there's the Black's franchise, and they got so many barbecue joints that the Black family has two different sets of restaurants because they got arguing over a restaurant, and now this side of the Black family doesn't talk to the other side of the Black family, and they have two different chains. I'm gonna eat at both of them. So, Terry Black's barbecue in Austin, Texas, right? Brisket costs $40 a pound. $40 a pound for Terry Black's barbecue. To feed my family, and you can go on their website and see it, a large family pack, which is 6 pounds of meat and 5 quarts of sides, and it's estimated to serve 10 to 12 people. I got a family of 10. Some of us are quite large in stature, let's put it like that way. And those who aren't large in stature eat like they're large in stature. So you can feed 10 people, 10 to 12 people, for $308. It's Terry Black's brisket. And the brisket was good at all the places I went to. I think we liked most of them. Some of the best I've had. But it was expensive. So this week I said, you know what? I need to start learning to cook brisket because, you know, Pastor Aaron cooked a wonderful brisket, you know, for our gathering a while ago. And when I'm down in Texas with the Oakstone family for the feast, sometimes they have these brisket smokeouts and things like that. So I bought a grill and I'm like, okay, I'm going to do the work and I'm going to cook this brisket. Right? So we've cooked two so far. Micah cooked one, I cooked one. It was all right. It wasn't bad. But I realized something about brisket. Right? So my brisket, from the time we actually started, we trimmed it, we dry brined it, then we smoked it. That was like a 2.5-day process. Right? Just to get the brisket. And the brisket went from like this big to like this big. I'm like, wait a minute, didn't you tell me you bought like an 18-pound brisket? How I end up with like 6 pounds of meat after everything? Why is he talking about brisket? Well, what I learned about brisket is something I already knew about steak and salmon and eggs. I'll tell you a secret about me that y'all might not know. I can cook. Like, I can cook. I'm a good cook. When Andrew and I first got married, okay, she didn't know how to cook. I was like, baby, let me show you how to make salmon. Now you taste the salmon, it's amazing. I like steak. I like the best steak in the world. I don't want to pay for the best steak in the world, so I learned to cook the best steak in the world, and guess what? I taught my son how to make the best steak in the world. He's amazing at it. So ask me the last time I cooked salmon. I don't. My wife can cook it. She does a good job. Ask me the last time I cooked steak. You know what? It was recent. He was at one of the UCG or Kagwa camps this summer, and I had a hankering for some steak, so I cooked it myself, and it was good. But what I discovered about brisket is the same thing I knew about steak and salmon. I like it better when other people cook it. I like it better when other people cook it. We could be at a family, just a family day. We are just chilling. Nobody has anything to do, right? And I want a steak. Do you think I'm going to get up and cook the steak? No, not when I have a son. I'm in the sermon. Just bear with me. Not when I have a son who can make a world-class steak. I think it tastes better when he does it. And whether it's salmon or I want eggs, and I'm laying in bed, and my wife is laying in bed next to me, and I want some eggs, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to look like this and say, baby, I want some eggs. Now, yeah, I can make eggs, but 100%, I promise you, it tastes better when she makes it. What I tell you, baby, I say, because you make it with love, and I could taste it. And that's what I discovered about brisket this week. My brisket was good. It was good. But I think I would rather pay Mr. Terry Black his $40 a pound. I'd rather buy the family meal for $308. Why? Because I don't have to do the work for it. I just get to enjoy it. With the brisket, there's so much waste and trimming and mess. Like, to get that perfect bark on it, there's grease everywhere, and then the cleanup. You gotta get your wood chips and do all that. Let's go back to the Bible and let's see if we can make a connection, because the title of this is Walking Back into Grace, right? Walking Back into Grace. And I started telling you about you enjoying the fruits of your labor and things like that. Yeah, I enjoyed the fruit of my brisket. I enjoyed the fruit of my steak. I enjoyed the fruit of my salmon, but not as much as when somebody else makes it for me. In Deuteronomy 6, verse 10 to 12, this is what God is saying. It says, when the Lord your God brings you into a land, he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and Jacob, to give you a land with large and flourishing cities you did not build. Houses filled with all good things you did not provide. Wells you did not dig. And vineyards and olive groves you did not plant. Then, when you eat there, wait, what? Okay, so I was talking about food, right? I'm in the text. I was talking about food, eating food, and enjoying food that you did nothing to get. When you eat there and are satisfied, be careful that you do not forget the Lord who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. So in the spring holy days, we talk about that freedom, right? Because Passover is when the freedom starts. Right? Unleavened bread is coming out of Egypt. And Pentecost is when the Spirit comes, right? Freedom. Freedom in the Spirit. So we see here that God, in this freedom, what he's promising them, because that's the goal. He's saying, that's what I'm going to do for you. I'm going to give you something you did not earn. Right? This isn't you being rewarded for something that you did. This is just grace. You're getting something that you didn't pay for it. The book of Numbers is divided into two main halves, and it's based on a generational focus. If you were to break down how the storyline of the book of Numbers, you can divide it this way. From chapters 1 to 25, I want you to read it, okay? It's talking about the old generation. The old generation. The generation that died in the wilderness because they wouldn't take the land. Chapters 1 through 25. Chapter 1 starts with the first sentence, a census, counting how many people they are and things like that, and the people who are supposed to enter the promised land. Then it talks about the laws, and that's important, the laws, right? Because we're talking about that, like laws and obedience and things like that. How you celebrate Passover. But then we talk about the rebellion. The rebellion. And you know, we typically think about the rebellion in just one sense, right? But they were a rebellious group. I don't want us to look down on them. I want us to learn from them because we have that same rebellious spirit in us. They did nothing but rebel. They rebelled about going into the land, right? Then Miriam and Aaron rebelled against Moses. We like to gloss that over. And then Korah, Dathan, and Abiram rebelled. And then the icing on the cake was when they rebelled and reveled with the people from Midian. So you read chapter 1 through 25, and you'll see rebellion, 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 rebellion. Let's read Numbers 16. We're just going to pick one. Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. Korah, Numbers 16, verse 1. Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kothan, the son of Levi, and certain Reubenites, Dathan and Abiram, sons of Eliab, and On, sons of Pilith, became insolent and rose up against Moses. With them were 250 Israelite men. This is important. Well-known community leaders who had been appointed members of the council. They came as a group to oppose Moses and Aaron and said to them, "You have gone too far. The whole community is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is with them. Then why have you set yourselves above the Lord's assembly?" This is very important because when we start talking about these feast days and the things we have to do, it could be easy for some of us to think, oh, we're special because we have this understanding, and then dictate to other people, hey, this is what you have to do. Guess what? I've seen that under the old format of the church, but I've also seen it under the new format where we're all kings and priests. You can't tell me nothing because we're all kings and priests. Okay. In verse 8, this is what Moses says. Moses also said to Korah, "Now listen, you Levites." These were Levites. "Isn't it enough for you that God of Israel has separated you from the rest of the community and brought you near himself to do the work at the Lord's tabernacle, to stand before the community and minister to them? He has brought you and your fellow Levites near himself, but now you're trying to get the priesthood too? It is against the Lord that you and all your followers have banded together. Who is Aaron that you should grumble against him?" Then Moses summoned Dathan and Abiram and the sons of Eliab, but they said, "We will not come." And listen to their context. "Isn't it enough that you have brought us up out of a land flowing with milk and honey to kill us in the wilderness?" Wait a minute. What land flowing out of milk and honey? You mean Egypt? "Now, moreover, you haven't brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey, or given us an inheritance of fields and vineyards. Do you want to treat these men like slaves? No, we will not come." Then Moses became very angry and said to the Lord, "Do not accept their offering. I have not taken so much as a donkey from them, nor have I wronged them." Wow. And that's just an excerpt, right? We could go into Miriam's rebellion. We can do that. We could go into the rebellion of the 10 spies. I talked about that story so many times. I'm not going to do it today. Or we could go into the last rebellion. You can read that in chapter 25. I am not going to get into it, but basically, God had to send a plague to kill out a bunch of them. But it started with the leadership. See, the Reubenites, Reuben was the oldest brother. So he thought that gave him some authority. I want us to take just an excerpt of the two censuses. I'm not going to go through it because it's so long. You know, Numbers is a long book. And we wonder, why does God put all these numbers in here? You know, this one begat this one, and this one begat that one, and there were 50,000 people over here, and 10 people over here. Let's look at Numbers, chapter 1, 22 to 23. This is the first census. This is when God wanted to start arranging them and getting them trained and find out how many fighting men there are so they could take the land. This is before the spies' rebellion. "From the descendants of Simeon, the second son, all the men 20 years old or more who were able to serve in the army were counted and listed by name, one by one, according to the records of their clans and families. The number from the tribe of Simeon was 59,300. That's when they got out of Egypt, right? That's how many they came with. That's just the men. Now, the second census is very important. Let's go to Numbers 26:14, just so we see what bad leadership, okay, and thinking you're entitled to something can do. Numbers 26, verse 14, it says, "These were the clans of Simeon, whose numbers were 22,200. That's almost a third. That's almost a third. Not quite, but they lost two-thirds of their numbers. In the rebellion before the plague, we had the chief of their clan behaving wildly with the Midians. And tens of thousands of them died in a plague because of it. So in the transition, like I told you in Numbers 26, because Numbers 26 now, it's counting the people 20 years old and up. Because remember, God gave them that curse. He said, you know what? I can't work with any of you guys who are above fighting age. You're too hard-headed. Every single one of you, you're going to die in the desert. So in Numbers 26, that's happened. And in Numbers 27, we see a different kind of story. So we talked about women in the church, right? Women in the body, how do you function? So we're going to be introduced in Numbers 27, verse 1. To Zelophehad's daughters. The daughters of Zelophehad, son of Hepher, son of Gilead, son of Machir, and the son of Manasseh, belong to the clans of Manasseh, son of Joseph. These are the names of his daughters: Mahala, Noah, Hogla, Milcah, and Tizra. They came forward and stood before Moses, Eleazar the priest, and the leaders and the whole assembly at the entrance of the tent of the meeting, and they said, "Our father died in the wilderness." Well, yeah, that's what happened to just about everybody's dad if he was over 20. "He was not among Korah's followers who banded together against the Lord. But he died for his own sin and left no sons. Why should our father's name disappear from his clan because he had no son? Give us property among our father's relatives." So Moses brought their case before the Lord, and the Lord said to him, "What Zelophehad's daughters are saying is right. You must certainly give them property as inheritance among their father's relatives and give their father's inheritance to them. Say to the Israelites, if a man dies and leaves no son, give his inheritance to his daughter. And if he has no daughter, give his inheritance to his brothers. And if he has no brothers, give his inheritance to his father's brothers. If his father had no brothers, give his inheritance to the nearest relative of the clan, they may possess it. This is to have the force of law as to the Lord commands." Now, this is important because when we think about some of the things we've talked about in the church, right? And some of the problems we've had, specifically with women serving, doing things, and executing things, there has been some people, some men, who look at this document and some of the laws that were made as something that made men superior to women, which was never the intent. But when you look at the law and you don't look at grace, okay, you can make every single excuse to divide. This new generation was very different than the older generation. When we drop down to Numbers 36, we're going to see that her clan, the men in her clan, came together to protect their brother or cousin, as well as his daughters. And it says, the family heads of the clan of Gilead, son of Machir, son of Manasseh, who were from the clans of the descendants of Joseph. Now remember, Manasseh and Ephraim were both Joseph. They were tribes of Joseph, and they were adopted by his father. They said, "When the Lord commanded my Lord to give the land as an inheritance to the Israelites, he ordered them to give the inheritance to our brother Zelophehad and his daughters. Now suppose they marry men from other Israelite tribes, then their inheritance will be taken from our ancestral inheritance and added to that of any tribe they may marry into. And so part of the inheritance allotted to us will be taken away when the year of Jubilee comes. Their inheritance will be added to that of any tribe which they marry into, and their property will be taken away from their tribal inheritance of our ancestors." Then the Lord commanded Moses and gave this order to the Israelites, "What the tribe of the descendants of Joseph is saying is right. This is what the Lord commands for Zelophehad's daughters. They may marry anyone they please as long as they marry within their father's tribal clan. No inheritance from Israel is to pass from one tribe to another. For every Israelite shall keep the tribal inheritance of their ancestors. Every daughter who inherits land in any Israelite tribe must marry someone from her father's tribal clan so that every Israelite will possess the inheritance of their ancestors. No inheritance may be passed from one tribe to another, for each Israelite tribe is to keep the land it inherits. So Zelophehad's daughters did as the Lord commanded Moses. Zelophehad's daughters, Mahala, Tiraz, Hogla, Milaka, and Noah married their cousins on their father's side. They married within the clans of the descendants of Manasseh, son of Joseph, and their inheritance remained in their father's tribe and clan. Now, this is important because we're talking about land. What does this have to do with grace? What does this have to do with walking in grace? Well, it's to establish something that the law that God provided was in the context that everyone is covered, everyone is safe, everyone receives justice, mercy, and faith. Those are the weightier matters of the law. And sometimes when we look at the letter of the law, you have to do this at this time or else, you miss the point. It's not about what you do, it's about how you grow. So, we go to Joshua now, right? They're in the land at this point. And it says in Joshua chapter 17, verses 3 and 6, it says, "Now Zelophehad, son of Hepher, son of Gilead, son of Machir, son of Manasseh, had no sons but only daughters, whose names were Mahala, Noah, Hogla, Milcaha, and Tiraz. They went to Eleazar the priest, Joshua, son of Nun, and the leaders, and said, 'The Lord commanded Moses to give us an inheritance among our relatives.' So Joshua gave them an inheritance along with the brothers of their father according to the Lord's command. Manasseh's share consisted of 10 tracts of land besides Gilead and Bashan east of the Jordan because the daughters of the tribe of Manasseh received an inheritance among the sons. The land of Gilead belonged to the rest of the descendants of Manasseh." This is so, so, so important. Right? We're talking about people who, if you just look at the letter of the law and a system that, you know, people could manipulate, would have lost everything. But God is saying, that's not the intent here. That's not the intent. So intent is important as we walk into these feast days. How are we looking at it? Right? So we talked about something. Hey, you can earn it, you can work for it, you can cook your own steak, you can build your own house, you can dig your own well, you can grow your own vineyard, or you can just walk into a house that's already filled with everything you need. That's what these ladies got. They got that milk and honey promise. How do we know that they got it? Well, it reaffirms it. And I want you to think about this. When you think about stories in the Bible, how many important stories you only hear about once in the Bible? You ever thought about that? You know, we talk about being born again, born again, born again. You only hear about that one time. It was one conversation. Being born again, one conversation. How many figures in the Bible only appear once? How many people we hear stories about, but we never hear their name? These five ladies are in two books of the Bible, and their names are in the Bible three times. Each of them, every single detail, how much land they got. And again, they didn't earn this land. Let's go further in Joshua. In Joshua 24, 12 to 14, God is going to say something. He said, "I sent the hornet ahead of you, which drove them out before you. Also, the two Amorite kings, You did not do it with your own sword and bow. So I gave you a land on which you did not toil, and cities that you did not build. And you live in them and eat from vineyards that you did not plant. So it's the same thing for the daughters and the son. They got all this by grace. They got all of this by grace. What does that mean? Well, it means unearned provision. Do we think about that when we think about the feast? Do we think, you know, I need to be here at this day in this time because God said so? That's true. It's not in conflict. But why? Why? Let's talk about the motivation. Why? See, the motivation is found in verse 14 when it says, "Now fear the Lord and serve him with all faithfulness. Throw away the gods your ancestors worshiped beyond the Euphrates River and in Egypt and serve the Lord." That's the why. See, grace is the why. Jesus Christ came and he died for you. On atonement, we're free from sin, not because we fasted, right? I'm free of sin because I fasted. No. You're free of sin because of grace. You're free of sin because Jesus Christ came and died for you. You're free of sin because he represents that lamb, okay, that's taken and slaughtered. He represents that year-old male without blemish that you keep for 4 days. And you take the blood and you put it on your doorposts. So in the fall or in the spring, it doesn't matter when you're singing those songs of ascent, you're saved by the grace that says, "Rescue me from these lying lips. Rescue me from these deceitful people. I can't do it on my own. I need rescue." If you can do it on your own, you need rescue. "I call on the Lord in my distress, and he answers me. Save me, Lord, from lying lips and deceitful tongues." That's how our journey to the feast starts. We're in need of a Savior. So it's of the unearned provision. It's a reminder of the grace. And what he's telling them here is stewardship, stewardship, stewardship. I gave you this. Right? So the obligation we have is not because we're earning something. The obligation we have is we get to do it because we're stewarding over this gift that God gave us. The theologian Paul Kopayan says it this way: "How did God address the patriarchal structures, the rights of the firstborn, polygamy, warfare, servitude, slavery, and a number of other fallen social arrangements that were permitted because of the hardness of human hearts?" It says, "He met Israel partway." As Jesus stated in Matthew 19:8, "Because of the hardness of your heart, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it hadn't been that way." We can apply, we can take the principle of that, and we can apply that to many problematic structures within their social arrangements. And guess what? God made laws because of it, so that people are protected because he understood the hardness of your heart. God changeth not. That's why you sons of Israel, you people in the church, are not consumed. He's the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow, because he is like that. So the reason he made this law is because we're imperfect. It's that schoolmaster that Galatians says, you know, no, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. You know, when Jesus Christ came, he expanded all of those, didn't he? Every single one. He didn't do away with them. He's the lawgiver. And we still have this hardness of heart. You know, the way I like to put it, like I said, I've never coveted my neighbor's ox. Right? Ever. Even for brisket, I'm not coveting it. No. I don't want your ox to make steak, brisket, nothing. Or your horse. I'm not coveting it. So they weren't ideal and universal in the sense that this is the standard. No, it's a starting place. It's a starting place. So when I say walking back into grace, grace is God's nature. Grace is, how do we know that grace is God's nature? Let's go back to the beginning in Genesis 2. And I want to show you something, because I don't want you to think that what he did for the Israelites was special. Right? I don't want you to think that. I want you to think that that's God's nature. That's how he does. That's his rule. That's not the exception. So yeah, you can work for something and he can bless you. And God does function that way. He's going to multiply what you do. Right? I mean, I want you to think about it. You put one kernel of corn in and you get, boom, a big ear of corn. Right? You put in one little nub of potatoes and you get like a big old pile of potatoes. That's what he does. That's his nature. He's going to multiply it for you. But in Genesis 2, verse 4, it says, this is the account of the heavens and the earth when they were created, when the Lord God made the heavens and earth. It says, now, no shrub had yet appeared on the earth, and no plant had yet sprung up. For the Lord God had not sent rain on the earth, and there was no one to work the ground. I want you to think about that. How God made the earth. See, he didn't make man and say, go plant everything, and I want you to till the ground. It said God planted a garden in Eden. And all you had to do was take care of it. So with that principle, we're right back to the principle that Joshua is going to tell us when he's sending the hornet ahead of them and he's giving them these cities that they didn't build. And that principle is stewardship. We get to do something. So I want us to walk in grace as we get the opportunity to keep these wonderful feast days. Because guess what? God has already done the work by sending Jesus Christ, his son, as our Passover sacrifice. We're not free of sin because we don't eat for 24 hours. We're free of sin because Jesus Christ died for us. And we're just being good stewards of that. I'm here on this atonement because my Savior died for me. And I accepted that sacrifice. I was sin-free yesterday because I accepted that sacrifice. And I'm obedient because of it. I get to do this. Jesus Christ is coming back for me. And he's going to make that blast like a loud trumpet. He's coming back because he died for me, and he loved me, and he promised me that. And I'm going to get my inheritance the same way the daughters of Zelophehad got their inheritance. No matter what circumstances may look like, it's God, rescue me. I'm a good steward of that. And I tabernacle with God. Because he came and tabernacled with us. And we get to do that. So as we walk back into grace, we can look at Psalm 128 and all the other Psalms of ascent in that context, that blessing of what God has done for us. Because even when we get to do something, God is the one multiplying it. God is the one opening the door. God is the one giving us knowledge. So the summer is winding down. And I know that makes some of you sad. This is my happy time of year. It's getting cooler. I'm going to get to be with God's people. And you know, that grace is good. The grace was good when I was in Detroit, living in the ghetto. It's good when I'm in Birmingham, living with all the snooty folk. The grace is still good because I'm going to be with God. I hope you enjoy walking back into grace this fall. You will eat the fruit of your labor. Blessings and prosperity will be yours.